Welcome to Connected on Purpose, a podcast about leadership, management, and getting great shit done. I'm April Burrows, the founding partner of Flow Office Wisdom, a socially minded company that works with small to medium-sized businesses and not-for-profits. Our purpose is to inspire and empower leaders by supporting their vision through mobilizing their plans and getting the tasks done. This podcast is for anyone who loves to glean insight from others, to evolve in their work, and believes they can lead their own life and at any level in an organization. Today, our topic is servant leadership and enhancing the capacity in people, and I'm going to be speaking with Laura Hanley. Laura is the ED of Community Living Guelph Wellington in my city in Ontario, Canada. I have known Laura since I founded my company and have grown to appreciate her wisdom, and over the years connecting with her as a sounding board for both professional and personal growth and life in general. To me, Laura is a leader of grace and humility, and I admire her greatly. Everyone who I know that has connected with Laura speaks so highly of her. For the past 26 years, Laura has been a not-for-profit professional. Throughout her career, Laura has grown organizations and their teams to improve services for clients. Previously, Laura was in the area of mental health services and had her own HR consulting firm focusing on the not-for-profit sector. Welcome, Laura. I'm so excited to be connecting with you today.
Thank you, April.
Today, I'm looking forward to learning from you on this topic. We have some great conversations over the years, and I'm excited. So,
me too.
So I know that you identify your leadership style as a servant leader. What does that mean to you?
For me, servant leadership has always been about walking beside others, or sometimes behind others, to build capacity in whatever way that we can to make sure that people can be successful in whatever roles they hold. I think that's the long-lasting way to lead, and I think that's the most successful way to approach it. I was fortunate to be able to take an authentic leadership course 3 years in a row in Nova Scotia a number of years ago, and they really promoted the servant leadership, and that is really walking beside people and not having to be the face of everything as a leader.
I definitely see that in you. That shines through in everything that I see you do. So I love that you said about enhancing the capacity in people. How do you actually do that?
Again, for me, it's really about walking beside people. If there's an issue or an opportunity that a person is dealing with or has the opportunity to explore, then we take a look at how it makes the most sense for me to help them do that. And again, it's not doing it for them, but it's actually building the capacity so that they can be the face of whatever that project is. They can be the successful person in that role, because at the end of the day, that's what a good leader should do, and that is really promote others and their abilities.
It's not always an easy thing to do for some people. Some of us actually like to be the ones out front.
Brene Brown had a quote, if I can just add it in here, that I really liked. And she said, a leader is anyone who takes responsibility for finding the potential in people and processes and who has the courage to develop that potential.
Ah,
which
courage.
Which kind of speaks to your...
Yeah, courage is so key to that for sure. So I have talked with you over the years and learned from you about working with people and helping them build their capacity and growing my own capacity through helping them grow their capacity. But what are some of the challenges when working with people in enhancing their capacity?
Probably the largest challenge I've come across is people who do not have insight into their abilities and capacity, or don't have or can't hear that feedback in order to help them grow. I have found that to be the challenging piece for me. I believe self-reflection is really important in all that we do, because we're always learning. We never have arrived. And if we all think we've arrived, then I kind of think we're done. People struggle sometimes to do self-reflection, and they also struggle sometimes to hear feedback. So it's really important to give feedback in a way that's supportive and respectful, all with the intention of building their capacity and building your relationship in the process. The challenge comes when people can't hear that or feel that their abilities are top-notch already and they really don't have to learn anymore. That becomes a different conversation sometimes, and a more difficult one that people struggle with.
But a necessary one.
But a necessary one, because it doesn't go away. If you don't have it, it's and you can't work with that person to help go through that process of building capacity, then they're going to be stuck. And then everybody gets stuck. And the workplace itself then is not so coherent or harmonious.
Mm-hmm. Courage is another big factor in being able to have that feedback with people, I think.
Absolutely.
I heard recently at a conference I was at that, and I really liked how they phrased this, that feedback is really the other person telling you what they value.
Mm. I like that.
I like that too.
That's very good.
Yeah.
It's true.
It is true. And that way you don't have to take, it sort of removes that feeling like somehow you're not worthy.
Right.
Or that you take it really personally, because mm-hmm. it really is more about the other person sharing what's really important. And I, you know, as a leader, I like to be able to share not just what's important to me, but what I know to be important in terms of living out the values, the mission, and the goals of the business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've been throwing that around a lot since then as like feedback. I think I've said it 3 or 4 times to different clients.
I think the use of self is important too. So what I try to do in those cases where I think that person is struggling with or will struggle with the feedback is I try to start with a story about me being in that position earlier on in my career, or where I've done something that, you know, wasn't the best way to approach a situation, and try to put myself out there first so that everybody's human. And it's not about perfection, it is about continuous improvement. So how, you know, what happened for me and how did I learn from that? And who was my mentor that helped me through that? And what did they say to me that I had to sit with for a while and then move forward with? That sometimes makes it easier to hear feedback if you're kind of putting yourself out there in a vulnerable way. I found that has been successful.
I have found that very helpful as well. My greatest learnings have been from where I've needed to grow up or grow into.
Absolutely.
Whatever role that I've had. Grow up maybe more times than often. But yeah, definitely being able to self-reflect and own your limitations at that moment. It's
exactly.
only at that moment anyways.
Yes.
But what I'm really getting from what you're saying is that, and I guess this would be really good, like we talk a lot about two and four leaders and managers in this podcast, but an employee as well, to know just to be open with your growing edges, because most often I have found managers want you to grow, leaders want you to grow, and they see that's their role.
Yes.
So if you can be open to it and just see that as them wanting you to succeed in the role that you have, you'll be better off for it, I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking now about the connection between, you know, giving feedback and enhancing capacity, but, you know, starting at the very beginning of a relationship with an employee, mm-hmm. and I know for Flo it's taken us a while to for us to know the best fit for us in our environment. So I'm going to ask you to put your HR hat on. What are your insights about recruiting really well? And I know you've helped us with that a little bit. So
I think with recruitment, the first key thing to remember is it's really critical to know what you need in that role. So I often tell people to just think about, if you're developing a role and you want to recruit in, how will you know if that role is successful or that person in the role is successful? What is it that you absolutely need from that role? And then work back from there. Both from the technical competencies, which are really important, but also from the soft skill side. Because you can have somebody who's technically A+, but emotional intelligence-wise is really struggling, and that could make or break the position as well. So I think if you're really clear about, A, what is the intention of the role, how will you know that role has been successful in your organization, and how will you determine if the person in the role has been successful? And then if you can come up with those successes and those markers and back it up from there to say, so I really need somebody who's resilient, because they're going to be talking to customers, potential customers all day that are not going to be friendly, and so this person needs to be able to bounce back from those conversations, for instance.
Mm.
You need to be then recruiting for that as one of those soft skills. Not someone who's just been in a customer service role for 10 years, because they could have been in 10 different roles because they couldn't handle those calls and they started to tell the customers, you know, where to go, or not really in a professional manner. So that's something I think that you have to be really mindful of. I think using behavior-based questions in an interview is really important too. Lots of people can answer the question, if you were in this situation, what would you do? But you learn a lot more, or I have anyway, learned a lot more when I have said, have you been in this type of situation? Can you talk about it? What did you do? What was the outcome? How did you feel during that process? Because then you're hitting on all of those markers of the technical and the soft skills as well. Mm-hmm. So I find that that's really, really critical as well. The job description, the onboarding process, all of those things are really, really quite important, I think.
It's like HR infrastructure is what we call it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And taking the time. So we're often very much in a crisis mode. We need this person. We need them right away. You've interviewed three people. One is okay. I think we could make this one work. Typically, that doesn't work out so well. It doesn't maximize your opportunity. So I really try to stress to people that don't let the crisis have you settle for somebody that you would not have otherwise settled for. Take the time at the front end. Because I think if you ask employers, they'll find out, or they'll tell you when they settled, oftentimes that person is no longer there. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of time, effort, and money wasted if the person's not going to work out.
Yeah, so I'm just going to circle back. You talked about emotional intelligence.
Yes.
Tell us what emotional intelligence is.
Well, for me, it's looking at all of the different indicators about who you are as a person, what you believe in terms of your values, your assumptions, your beliefs, your experiences, yourself, your use of self, your outlook on yourself, your use of how you, just how you live in the world, for me, is what... I'm probably not describing it accurately, but for me, that's what it means.
I thought it was good just to, because what I'm putting together now is that it also takes emotional intelligence, the part of the person doing the interviewing and hiring, and the organization as a whole, because if you get caught in that panic mode, then something's not culturally coherent with what you're trying to accomplish is exactly. Kind of what I'm picking up from what you said.
Yeah, and with small organizations, it's you're in crisis mode more often than not, because in larger organizations you might have multiple positions that could pick up while there's a vacancy.
Right.
In a smaller organization where you have a lot of one-offs positions, that position goes, that might be 25% of your workforce, and it's typically the president, the owner, the whatever, that senior position that is having to pick up the slack.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So the hiring, like the hiring process, assuming it's going really, really well and you've got the right person, what are some of those like really important tips about onboarding well? Because I know that we've done some really good hiring, but not always done the best onboarding. And we've learned through the years that how important and key that is to our success as an organization. So what are your thoughts about onboarding well?
Yeah, onboarding for me is a process that can actually take, I could say, depending on the organization, 3 to 6 months to effectively onboard someone totally to your organization. People usually make the choice within the first 90 days of whether or not they're going to stay. And it's not often because of money. It'll be because they haven't been able to connect with their supervisor effectively. They don't understand their role effectively. They don't understand how their role fits within the larger organization. And they don't often understand how they fit with their peers and just how it all works. So if someone's still floundering even after, say, 30 days, then they're already starting to think about whether or not this is the right position for them. And if they haven't established any of those relationships, and the most important one actually is with their direct supervisor, if they haven't established those, they're already looking for an out plan often. So I'm going to start looking for another job. I think I need to tell them that I can't do this. And then it goes on and on and on in their mind from there. Mm-hmm. So onboarding is critical. And I think you need to map it out with one of the first most important relationships is getting to know the supervisor. So sometimes what happens is, you know, we have a week long orientation. You're going to spend a day with each person and then you're going to hit the ground running. Sometimes that works. But if the supervisor isn't front and center in all of that, then that relationship does not get established. They might get established with the peers that they've spent a day with, but then if that's not sustained going forward, because again, in smaller organizations, you have a lot of people doing different things, mm-hmm. So there's not a natural coming together. So putting that natural coming together is, I think, really important as well. If possible, having a buddy system that that person can attach to if they have any questions, if they need to check in on something, if they don't understand a process, if they have one person that they know they can go to other than their supervisor, that has been found to be quite helpful as well. Mm-hmm. But it's that connection and knowing what difference am I making in your organization and how does my role fit with the larger vision of the organization.
Mm-hmm. I think most critical. People really, really want to contribute.
Absolutely. Everybody yeah. wants to do good.
So if you don't know how you're contributing in your role, it's going to be to the greater whatever. And yeah. that can be any kind of business. Hopefully, I mean, my hope is that all businesses have a greater purpose than just profit. But
yes.
But those are that's our audience anyways, is the not-for-profits yeah. and the businesses who are wanting to make a difference in the world.
Yes. So I think spreading things out, making sure you're not overwhelming them in the first week with all of the policies, procedures, signing. Lots of people say in the first week, you got to meet with HR, you got to sign up with all your benefits and stuff, but your benefits don't start for 3 months. So really, those are the kinds of things you really don't need to do in that first week. I think it's important in that first week to talk about who we are as an organization, establish relationship with the supervisor. What kind of approach do you have in your organization? If you're a person-centered organization, what does that mean for you? And just talk about that so that you're trying to set the tone of culture from day one. Mm-hmm. And that will help with the buy-in of staying, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense. We're a virtual company, so that relationship building is a challenge. It's really a challenge.
It is, but I find you and your organization do that extremely well. You meet at restaurants and cafes mm-hmm. and or in this office or whatever, but you make sure that you take the time for that relationship building, which is so very critical, and I think that your organization and your staff do it an excellent job at
oh,
that.
Oh, well, thank you, Laura. You've been a part of helping us pull it all together for sure. So I know for us, we have different styles of people and what their needs are, and we have different ages, and we have different backgrounds in terms of being, you know, maybe coming from the educational world, like a university or something, or a for-profit, more corporate setting, or another not-for-profit. They come in. Everybody seems to have their own needs. When it comes to that relationship or how you work with people or what a lot of it is what you expect from management. Mm-hmm. Have you run into that sort of generational type of question or scenario what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so we're in an interesting time and an interesting generational time. In many organizations, there are four generations working at the same time. That is because the 65-year-olds can work longer. There's not that mandatory retirement age, and we have everybody from the baby boomers down are all entering the workforce. They all have very different needs, and I think as a baby boomer, we tended to be those loyal ones. We're going to have a career with one organization. We're going to be there forever. We're going to retire. We're going to get the gold watch, and I'm going to work for you as many hours as you need me to work for. Whereas today's folks coming into the workforce are all about balance. They're not living to work, they're working to live. So their work is their important part. They need to know they're actually making a positive impact, and they need to know that fairly quickly, because if they don't feel that, then they disengage and they move on. And you can tell with younger folks today that they can have 5, 6, 7 careers in their work life, where that was not the case with the baby boomers at all. But they're looking for impact, they're looking for work-life balance, they want time with their families, they want to travel, they don't want to wait till they retire to do that. Mm-hmm. So they're making different life choices. And I talked to some senior leaders in some organizations who call them the lazy generation. But I did go to I remember 20, 25 years ago, I went to a course, and there was a professor from Queen's University, and she challenged us back then. She said at this point in time, she said 2020, I think, we were going to have a very different looking workforce. And we were going to call them the lazy generation. However, she challenged us to think that they were actually the healthy ones, because they were going to have work-life balance. They were going to travel. They were going to work, and they were going to do things that they really loved to do. But they were also going to have the courage to leave and move on to other things and keep stretching and growing, where maybe the baby boomers didn't do that as well. Mm-hmm. And the baby boomers would work 12, 14-hour days if that's what needed to be done, whereas now, not so much. And she challenged us to think that that's not necessarily lazy, that's healthy.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm thinking about, I think we're kind of somewhere in the middle. My kids are entering the workforce stage. I hate to admit it, but it's true. And we definitely have some really skilled young people in our company as well. We found it tricky to be sort of have that drivenness that feels like it comes from the baby boomers, but also that life balance. So yes, we do want people to not work. I mean, sometimes you have to work an extra long day, but then you take a little bit of time off later on. So we do want people to have that spaciousness to be able to work sort of fluidly like that. The other thing that we've run across is sometimes you just have to do things you don't like to do.
Yes.
And how do you help people who are so purpose-driven to understand that sometimes everybody just has to do some jobs that mm-hmm. aren't their favorite jobs?
Yeah. And for me, that starts back at the recruitment process. And it's part of their orientation and it's part of use of self. Mm. I talk a lot with new employees about how, you know, there are lots of things I don't like to do, but I need to do them. And I've had that in any job that I've been in. But you can imagine any job will have that. It's kind of that other duties as assigned on a job description, right? as well as a few of the areas. But I think just being really clear and knowing that whether or not we like them, they have to get done, and we're all going to take our turns doing them. If there's a job that's created with all of the things that nobody likes to do, that job would never be successful because it would be all of the things nobody likes to do, and nobody who would take that job.
Yeah.
So if you can spread it around and you can show people that we're all doing that, I find that eases it up a bit. It doesn't necessarily make it any more fun to do the jobs that we don't like to do, but I think there's a recognition that we all have that.
I like in my own mind when I'm doing the things that I don't necessarily like to do, I can normally find a path towards the end goal, though. Like why these particular things are important to the end goal.
Yeah.
If I can't do that, then I've got to ask myself, are they actually the right things to be doing?
Exactly.
Are we just doing them because we've always done it?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they have a purpose? So for me, if I can find the purpose even in the mundane, it really helps me. And I'm not a person who likes details and
I know that about you.
Yeah. So I do find it a struggle, but I have, you know, learned over the years to do that, to connect it with the bigger goal. And it's like a building block. It's part of the, I don't know, building the wall or whatever it is.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And it is about that. How does what I do impact the larger organization and what we stand for?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that's photocopying agenda packages. Like, what does that do for people, right?
Some people actually like to do that.
I know.
So, in the generational sort of topic,
mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts around leadership styles with those different generations? Like, like, because you really talked about servant leadership, are there different types of leadership that tend to show up with different age groups, or is there servant leadership kind of the goal, like for you, when building leaders?
For me, that's the goal, and that's how I approach things. There are many different kinds of leadership. You can have a democratic, you can have an autocratic, you can have a consensus type environment. Why I feel more successful using servant leadership, or why I feel it's just more natural for me, is it's about building capacity. So in whoever. So you need to know who the whoever is. You need to know what's important for them. Mm. And you need to work with their strengths and to help them develop further. And so if people are coming in different generations, different thoughts, different needs, you need to understand what that is so that you can best connect with them and move forward. Because if I can't connect with somebody, then why would they listen to me? Why would they want to even have me help them become more successful? And for me, if I don't know a person, then I don't know how best to serve them. I don't know how best to support them in becoming a better person or becoming a better leader or becoming a better whatever. So I really, you just really need to know what drives them. And for me, that's having conversations. You know, what is important to you? Why are you in this role? What do you hope to see? What do you think about our organization? Do you understand how your position fits in with our larger mission, vision, value? And what are your aspirations? And then how do we get there? How do I help you get there? How do I support you? What do you need from me? What do you need from others? You know, what can we get from you? All of those conversations, I think, are so important to know what you're working with. And then it's a two-way street. Because in those conversations, you're also giving of yourself. And you're also letting that person know a bit more about you.
I like you mentioned about strengths. So I really resonate with the like leveraging people's strengths. Because sometimes they come in with the soft skills and the hard skills that you're looking for. But then there's this untapped thing that emerges, right? Yes. Then you realize, wow, they're actually really good at communicating in this particular way. Or, yeah, do you find that as well?
Yes. And when people feel appreciated for what they're already doing, then I think they free themselves up to be able to show more of themselves to you. Well, I can also do this. And I really enjoy that. Even though that's not part of my role, I really enjoy that. Well, if you enjoy that and you can see their skills in that area, then as leaders, we tuck that away because we know at some point we could be able to help develop that further in an organization. And then we find opportunities to do that. But if you don't connect with that person or know that person, you would not know that about them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about, it sounds a bit cliche, but it's all about the relationship.
It is all about the relationship.
At the end of the day, it's about that relationship.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And that relationship can be a 20-year-old, it can be a 65-year-old, or anywhere in between. It's about the relationship with that person.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's another piece of the relationship with the organization. Because you want to build it strong enough that if any of those key players that were working with those, that had the relationship with that particular person, goes away, you want them to feel strongly about the organization.
Yes, true.
Yeah, and that's back to that vision, mission, value stuff that you're talking about.
And tying
it all back in.
Yeah,
for sure.
So whatever the position is, tie it in. Whenever you're having conversations about planning, tie it in to your mission, vision, values, and your strategic plan. If it doesn't fit in those, then I always try to question why we're having the conversation or why we're considering something if we can't make it fit, easily fit, in one of those areas. If we're struggling to push it, then it's really either we need to change our strategy or our vision and mission as an organization, or we need to just not have that conversation any longer because it's not fitting. It's not a natural fit to who we are.
The world is changing so much and jobs are changing so much that I think that's where that tying everything back to the vision and mission really comes into play.
It's critical. And I know even in the organization I'm in now, families in the very beginning, I think they were surprised at how many times I referred back to the vision and mission statement. Because I said, that is my guiding light. So it says that we're going to facilitate opportunities for people with developmental disabilities to live in their communities. So their communities are their communities. They're all of our communities. Whereas I think some families were like, well, their community is the DS community, right? And so there was just that whole, it was surprising that there was a different understanding of that, because all of our literature talks about inclusion and living in community. So that was a bit of work that I would not have anticipated doing, but it was really important to do, and I'm grateful that the families have walked alongside us to do that. It's clear, it's important to be clear about the meaning of your mission, vision, values as well.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking about our whole thing about this podcast is getting the right shit done. And, you know, sometimes working on that higher level, ensuring that that culture is really solid, is the right shit. It may not be the crossing the T's and dotting the I's details that other people think should be done. And sometimes you have to go up a few levels in what you're talking about to get people aligned and back on track.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's cool.
It could be like herding cats.
Sometimes. It can be. Well, I think the other thing, it's like you said, the onboarding process or the hiring process, do it slow. Slow down and do it well and don't get into a panic. Well, culture and changing culture and all that sort of, that's also a long process. It takes time. It's not like, I've just reinvigorated our vision and mission and we'll throw it up in the wall and all of a sudden everybody gets it. That is not how it works.
No. You really do have to point it back to all that you do, and people get sick of that sometimes, but eventually, and now in our organization, it's pretty routine. People can cite the mission vision, they can understand where their role fits, and if they can't, then they know that there's a mechanism to have that conversation. We're not there yet by any means, but we're certainly making good progress, which I appreciate.
Mm-hmm. And it does take time. And for us as a new company, just 6 years old, knowing what culture we actually need to meet our goals has changed, because it started with a small group of people and the culture was sort of one way. And that as we grew and developed, we had to keep refining. So it does take time. And then if you're in a whole organizational shift or you've pivoted in a business or something, it might mean that you need to take a look at all of that again. And then it's almost like starting over. It's like starting a business over, an organization over, and looking at what that purpose is or what that why is or however you see that, whether it's vision and mission or purpose or...
Mm-hmm. And I think in all of that, around the culture building piece in particular, it is about being open, being transparent, being human. Again, if I don't know how many times in my career I've stood up and said publicly, this could have gone better, or we really screwed that one up and we're going to learn from that and here's what we're going to do different next time. And I think that doing that in and of itself, when leaders can do that, they're demonstrating that they're human. Mm-hmm. They're demonstrating that they're not perfect, and that we'll own what we own and we're going to change it. We're going to learn from it and we're going to change it. And I think that speaks volumes to staff when staff can see people be vulnerable like that and be okay with that, because it is about learning. And we do all make mistakes, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm,
we just need to learn from that and do different next time.
That really builds the trust.
It does.
It builds the trust in actually the culture of the organization. It's much more, it's not a top-down, this is what we do and this is why you do what we do. It's really, we're in this all together, which is way more the kind of environment I want to be doing 8 hours, 10 hours of my day.
Exactly.
And is an environment like that. That makes total sense. And that's back to that servant leadership. And you also talked about authenticity.
Yeah.
That sort of wraps that all together.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you have a couple guiding principles that you live by, and you've shared them with me, so I know what they are, but share them with the audience. What are a couple of the quotes or guiding principles that you do your leadership from?
Well, I've always loved quotes, and I seem to relate well to some specific ones. And two that have kept popping up over the years of my career just keep surfacing for me. So I just listen to that now, and I just tell everybody that I love these two quotes and why. So one of them is, do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better, from Maya Angelou. Mm. And that one, I think, talks about the continuous improvement versus perfection theory, right? I mean, we know what we know, we do what we do, we try to do the best we do with the information that we have, but new information is always coming in. We're always learning. I'm a lifelong learner, and I know you are as well. Mm-hmm. So we're always learning new things, and the world is changing at such a rapid pace that it's unprecedented, and we have to keep up with that. So as we learn more things, we are going to change the way we do things. So for me as a leader, it's just being okay with saying, yeah, we did this back in the day because that was what we knew and that was the best at the time. But now we know we can do better, so let's shift that and go to this next step. And I think that is okay.
Yeah, for sure. I apply this to, maybe somebody did something that I would have done differently, and I just say to myself, they did the best they could with what they knew.
Exactly.
And so now it's my job to help them know better.
Yes.
Yeah,
and you
totally.
Give them that information and talk about how that might be used differently the next time.
Absolutely. I always say at Flow, any mistake is fine as long as you learn from it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you do it 3 or 4 times, we're going to have a different conversation.
Yes, absolutely. but it's okay. And I really appreciate it when staff say, hey, this happened. I wished I had done it differently, or can you help me see how I could have done it differently because I didn't like the outcome. I that builds trust with my staff when they come and share, you know, where things didn't go as smoothly as that they had hoped, or they made a mistake or whatever.
Right. And I've appreciated those conversations with you over the years as well, because we've both had them with each other about things that we've done or things that we didn't do that we wish we had. And I appreciate being able to have the conversation to know, because again, having the conversation about something I did makes me vulnerable. So you need to be able to trust that person, right, as well. So that is part of your culture.
Mm-hmm.
It all ties back.
It does all tie back. I know for me, it takes courage to admit my mistakes. It really does take courage.
It does.
And right. It's more that it's actually harder for me to forgive myself.
Yes.
Than I think it is anybody else forgiving me, but I forget that most of the time.
Yes, I'm with you on that. We do set the bar kind of high on that one, don't we?
We do. And as a culture, we're not really, we don't really tend to give people permission like that.
No.
There is a whole lot of posturing and performing out there mm-hmm. that I do not find helpful at all.
And competition.
Competition, yeah.
And competition in ways that are just not productive or helpful. There is a lot of work out there for everybody.
There is more than enough everything for everybody.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You just need to partner.
Mm-hmm.
My second quote that I love is by Nelson Mandela, and it is, the greatest glory in living lies not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall. Mm. So for me, that's really about resilience. And it's helped me put some things in my life into perspective, whether that's been difficult family issues or critical health issues or any of those things, as well as my career, mm-hmm. just to be able to say, yep, we're all going to fall at some point. But, you know, the true courage, resilience is in getting back up each time and moving forward. Mm-hmm. So I always kind of tilt back to that one as well, because I feel I've done that several times over my life. And each time I've come out that other side, a better person for it.
Yeah, that's the key. You come out, if you can look at it from what did you learn? Not that, like, something out there made this happen for you to learn the lesson.
Yes.
It's more, that there's an opportunity to grow
mm-hmm.
through it, for sure. And if you can seize it, yeah. I think when you seize it, you don't become bitter. But when you don't seize it, you become a bit bitter, which is unfortunate. And I think some people live from that bitter place.
Yes.
But, so you've explained sort of what the meaning is of it, these quotes are for you. Like, when you're in a situation, do they, like, pop into your mind and you're like, that's your touchstone?
They actually do. And that's why I've learned to really pay attention to them. I actually have them on my wall in my office, which I didn't realize until yesterday. Because I see them all the time and now they're in my head.
Mm-hmm.
That yesterday I was looking for something on the wall beside my desk and they were right there.
That's awesome.
But I do. And I find myself sometimes in really difficult situations. I just find myself even repeating the quote of Maya Angelou, just, you know, and again, it's do the best you can right now in this situation, whether it's with a family, a person supported, anybody in mm-hmm. life, and just say, okay, what is the best you can do in this situation? And then afterwards, spend a bit of time reflecting on that to say, is that how I would handle it next time? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
And if I find that, and again, this isn't easy to do, but I think once you do it a few times, it becomes easier. If I truly feel afterwards that I really mishandled that, whatever that conversation was, I swing back around to that person and say, you know what? I really wish I had done that differently, and here's what I wish I would have done differently, and I apologize for the way I handled that. And people sometimes are quite stunned by that because they either didn't even notice because they don't know you, mm-hmm. so they don't know how you mm-hmm. would have handled mm-hmm. it differently. Or maybe they don't care because they really just wanted to get their point across, or they're genuinely thankful that we took the time to come back, Right.
Yeah, I learned that technique in a course called Courageous Conversations a year ago. I think you were at that course.
I was.
I think you put on that course, actually, come to think of it, when you were at Trellis or whatever it was at the time. Yep. Yeah, I went to it because of you. That is so funny. No, I've learned that, and I find that very helpful, and I always say to people, just ask for a do-over.
Yeah.
Just ask for a do-over. It's amazing how much that can build a relationship back to everything's about the
Absolutely.
Relationship.
And when you're a parent, or even when you're a child, and your parent says to you, you know, you've done something wrong, well, you need to go apologize to that person. Like, I how many times have you said that to somebody, or to your children, or how many times have your parents said that to you growing up? It's no different. It's just, in my world, if I really would have done that differently, or I missed something important, or whatever it was, if it's niggling at me and it's not going away, then I need to resolve that. Mm-hmm. And I need to do it back with the person that mm-hmm. I had the conversation with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Do you have any scenarios or stories that you could share? Talk about vulnerability that you could talk about that helps us see how these quotes play out?
Yes, I can think of one situation where I had a room full of neighborhood people who we had rented a home in that neighborhood, and they were not happy with the tenants that were there from our service. Not yeah. happy at all. And rightly so. They had some very legitimate concerns. I don't feel that we were handling the situation as seriously as what it was for them. They were an older, well-established, small neighborhood. It was one of those neighborhoods where families grew up and then maybe the parents moved out and the kids bought the house. It was one of those. Mm. And so the concerns got so much for them as a neighborhood that they asked to meet with me. So I had 35 people in a room. It was every neighbor on the street, all needing to share their concerns with myself and a couple of my staff. And I remember standing there and listening to all of their stuff. And there was tears. There was a whole bunch of stuff going on for them. And all I could do was to stand there and say I was sorry that we did not handle that the way that we should have. And that I made a commitment to them going forward that we were going to do things differently and that we were going to rectify the situation at hand, but I needed 90 days to do that. And so they came back in 40 days to see, we invited everybody back and so we could give them an update. And we talked about that, had them back in 90 days, the situation had been rectified and the neighborhood was happy. But everybody came back for those next two meetings, and in the third meeting they actually stood up and clapped for us and said thank you for listening to them, for acknowledging where we had fallen down, and for making ourselves vulnerable in the face of angry neighborhood people.
Wow, that sounds like loaded situation.
It absolutely was, because they were just coming from it was a generational thing. I was raised in this neighborhood. I'm raising my children in this neighborhood. We can't do this. My parents come back. It was total emotion. And you can't discount people's emotions. Mm. That's just disrespectful. You can't. You just need to hear them and apologize that that's the experience that they're having, and apologize for what we were not doing well, mm-hmm. or what we had not done well to that point. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of it all, I think that's where they left with. We listened. We did something about it. But they said, in particular, the kind of grandparents of the room, in particular, what they felt was that not only did we listen and act, but we actually acknowledged what we hadn't done well.
Hmm.
And that's not been their experience with people. So that was emotionally exhausting, I have to say. It was very difficult. And inside, I was ready to vomit. But on the outside, it was what I needed to do. And it was what we needed to do as an organization, was to own it.
How did you prepare for that? Because I think something you said earlier about, you know, going into a situation and you go in trying to do the best that you can do. To me, that says that it takes some awareness of where you're at and what you're feeling and what you think the solutions are in order to even show up that way.
Yeah.
So what preparation did you do to show up well for that particular action? Because that's a biggie.
Yeah. And so I'd had a couple meetings with the people that were joining me, because they were like, oh my God, I can't, this is going to be, you know, they're going to be yelling, they're going to be, and I'm like, yep, probably. But here's what we need to know is, and in my world, I always try to think of this is, it doesn't matter if the situation we're talking about is reality or our perception.
Mm.
People come from their place of perception and their experience of that situation. So rather than trying to argue that point, just let that happen. Acknowledge and honor that that is their experience, and then move on.
Hmm.
I mean, I can argue the point that that was not our intention, and well, that really didn't happen in that way, and it only happened once, not 10 times. That's not helpful, because then you're trying to diminish their position, and I just don't find that helpful. Some people do, and it works. I have not found that to be helpful. To me, it's if I can acknowledge that here's where you're at, and your perception is your reality. So I can't impart my reality on top of yours, because then I'm dismissing how you feel about the situation. So if we can just honor and listen to the emotions that are coming forward, and yes, that must be really difficult. I'm really sorry that that's been your experience. I'm not saying that it's right or wrong. I'm not saying that it really happened or it didn't. I'm just saying this is how you're feeling, and I need to honor that.
Mm.
And so then if we can get past that, then we can talk about how do we move forward in a productive way, and what can you do, and what can we do, and what can everybody commit to? And what do I need to own in the situation? So if I can go into most situations knowing that I'm going to own what I own, and for me, that's just a natural thing. I know what I, in a situation, I know what I didn't do well. I know what we as an organization should have maybe done earlier. Typically, I know that. I knew that because this took a lot of planning to get everybody in the room at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
If they had showed up at my door unannounced, I probably would have vomited before I went in the room. But I think I still would have gone into the room the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to hear you out. So let's hear you out first. Like, let's get there. What is it? What are the key things?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then I just really try to talk about how to move forward. Mm-hmm. But not until you've heard people's angst,
yeah.
Emotions, yeah. Anger, whatever that is.
It sounds like you've built this up over your career, though. Like, you didn't just arrive at this knowledge.
Yeah, no. I like to give credit to my dad. My dad was a talker. So in life, when I was growing up, if I did something wrong, if I was struggling with something difficult, I knew I could have a conversation with my dad. And he was always that guy who he listened. He talked, he gave his perspective. He never diminished my opinion or my value or my rationale for doing something. He never discounted it.
Mm.
He listened, and then he would talk me through that and we would move forward. So he was that guy for me, and I think that was really critical for me, and I hope that that's what I've been able to do in my career. And I've had feedback throughout my career I can listen to people,
mm-hmm.
and I can kind of be where they're at. You have to be where people are at.
Yeah.
You can't drag them kicking and screaming to where you want them to be.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of go along. And again, it goes back to walking alongside people.
Mm-hmm.
No matter who it is and no matter what life situation you're in,
mm-hmm.
it is walking alongside and not being in front and dictating the process and diminishing people's experience.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier that little quote that I said that I learned is people are just telling you what they value.
Yes.
And they're giving. So they were really giving you feedback.
Yes.
And they were sharing with you what they valued.
Yes.
And so it sounds like you didn't take it personally. You just owned it and owned what you needed to, and you helped everybody move on. That is incredible. What a great story.
Well, and 9 times out of 10, if you think about things when you talk about values, if people are telling you what they value, you can do a quick check in your mind. And 9 times out of 10, it will be very similar to your values, right?
Mm-hmm.
We want our children in a safe neighborhood. I want to know that I can go walk my dog at 11 o'clock at night and not have to feel unsafe. I want to know this. I want to know that. There's not garbage in the street. I want it, right? We all want that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you can relate to somebody, and that's where you can be with that person is, yes, absolutely. That is your right as a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we make that happen?
Yeah, the common ground.
Yeah.
Back to relationship again.
I know.
Things back to relationship.
And to this day, those neighbors will still talk to me.
That is
so
awesome.
So I'm grateful.
Yeah, that is awesome. Well, I thank you for your relationship with me. I really appreciate the time that you gave us and the audience today and all your knowledge around working with people and in stressful situations and, yeah, and over the years, how you've actually been that listening for me and reflecting back a lot of what I'm going through and helping me see where I can grow and change. So anyways, as always, it's so much fun to connect with you. So thank you, Laura, for being a part of our Connecting on Purpose podcast.
Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap.
Yay.
Wow, this was a jam-packed conversation with tons of incredible practical and wise advice. One of the most loving things we can do for ourselves as leaders is learning from others. Laura gave us that gift in spades of learning from her years of experience and knowledge building. Loving ourselves is often one of the most difficult things to do, and Laura reminded us that receiving feedback well is loving ourselves, not expecting perfection from ourselves. Owning our own limitations and admitting your mistakes is all a form of loving self. She also was putting emphasis on our vision and not accepting good enough or not responding out of stress is also a form of loving ourselves and our vision. I know she talked a lot about walking alongside others and supporting growth, but I took a spin of loving yourself in closing because I think to truly support others, we have to walk the talk. How can we authentically offer those words of wisdom if we don't believe it enough to live it ourselves? So on that note, I say, feel my appreciation for who you are today and every day, and hope to have you back on another episode of Connected on Purpose.